Okay, so our first question, it says, from my understanding, a day is as a year in prophecy. In Jeremiah 25, 11 to 12 and 29, 10, it talks about nations serving Babylon, the nation serving Babylon for 70 years. And in 34, 14, it says at the end of 7 years, every man will be set free and his Hebrew brother and so forth. Why is it not a day of the year? What's this discrepancy? First off, you've got two different things going on here. The every man will be set free every 7 years is talking about if a Hebrew goes into the servitude of slavery, that every 7 years you had to set the slave free. This was a literal time period. It wasn't prophetic. So that's what that's referring to. And then I will tell you, I have not researched this question in Jeremiah about the 70 years. My understanding off the top of my head may be wrong. I'll have to study this. But just off the top of my head, my reflex answer as to why it was a literal 70 years, not a prophetic 70 years, is because this prophecy was given to the people at that time for them to experience in their day. And therefore, some of those people who received Jeremiah's prophecy were still alive, like Daniel, who was praying for the fulfillment 70 years later at the time when it was fulfilled. Whereas the day for a year prophecy are future prophecies for future generations that aren't going to actually experience the fulfillment in their time. So that's the difference I would make on those off the top of my head. But I'd have to study that deeper to be certain. What do you think about Genesis saying that Elohim, plural, created the earth? And John chapter 1 says that the Word, Jesus, created all things. Did Jesus create, or did all members of the Godhead create collaboratively? I would encourage you to go to the website, type in Trinity, read my two blogs on the Trinity, where I go through this very, very question, and I use the plurality of Elohim. You'll get a lot more details, a lot more Bible references on this. But my understanding is the Godhead, all three members have the ability to do this, but all three members work cooperatively in different roles. The Father is the source of all things. Jesus is the agent that acts in linear time to make specific things happen historically. So through the Old Testament, Jesus is acting in different places. And the Holy Spirit is the actualizer. So you do read in Genesis that the Spirit of God was over the face of the deep. And then you read that Jesus, when he said to his disciples, received the Holy Spirit, breathed on them, and they received. So Jesus is acting in real time in history, yet then the Holy Spirit acts. And so all three are taking different roles. And the reason that emphasizes that Jesus is the member through which they acted in a particular way for the creation was because the allegations of Lucifer were claims of equality against God the Son, not against God the Holy Spirit or God the Father. And thus, Jesus was the action arm in time through which these things were made, but they were all working cooperatively. I sat in a Bible study class where it was said that if we reject Christ, he sends lies and deception. And they're referencing 2 Thessalonians 2:11. And then this person references the story of Micaiah in 1 Kings 22. And they asked me to explain these two. In 2 Thessalonians 2:11, this is the lost. They are lost because they did not love the truth and thus be saved. And therefore, God gave them over to strong delusion to believe a lie. Let's explain that first. So the reason they're lost is because they did not love the truth. First, it isn't that they didn't love their religion or their doctrines or their creeds or the church. They didn't love the truth, meaning God is infinite, we're finite, truth is infinite, lovers of truth have hearts that are advancing, moving forward in truth. Truth is unfolding. They don't discover some truth, lay down stakes, and then refuse the advancing truth. For instance, before AD 2 or whatever it was, before Christ's birth, if you were a Jew living in Palestine in BC 30, it would be true that the Messiah is going to be born in Bethlehem. At AD 50, when Paul is preaching, it is no longer true that the Messiah is going to be born in Bethlehem. Thus, if you're a lover of the truth, you accept that truth has been fulfilled and you're looking for truth advancing. But if you're not a lover of truth, you reject the truth that Christ was born like many of the Jews did, then they're still looking for the Messiah to be born in Bethlehem. There's no truth in that. they're holding to a doctrine that was true at one point in time, but it's no longer true. You follow what I'm saying? Okay. And so on any subject matter, there is truth, and then there's everything else. If you go out today and you look at the sky, and let's say the sky is a clear and a bright day, and it's a beautiful blue sky, and we say to you, the sky is blue. And then we get out a light meter that can measure the wavelength of light, and we can give you the exact wavelength of light that is being refracted and say, and that's 1,080 nanometers light refraction going on. And we present this truth to you that's blue, and that's the wavelength. You're still free to reject it. You can say, I refuse to believe that. Okay. And if you don't accept the truth, what's left for your mind to land on? I don't believe it's blue. I believe it's purple. I believe it's green. I believe it's orange. I believe it's gray. It doesn't really matter. Once you reject the truth, the only thing left for your mind to rest upon is a lie. And this is what the Bible is saying in Thessalonians. Those who don't love the truth are given over to strong delusion to believe a lie. Or some versions actually make it God sends them delusions. Well, he doesn't send them delusion. He sends them the truth, and they reject the truth, and the only thing left is delusions. And so people will become delusional. They'll become fixed in false beliefs if they reject the truth. That's what it's saying in Thessalonians. The First Kings, though, this does not apply. In First Kings, it's the story of Ahab asking Jehoshaphat to join him in a war against Ramoth-Gilead. Jehoshaphat asks for a prophet of the Lord. Ahab is getting prophets of Baal to tell him to go, he'll succeed. Ahab says, I hate the prophets of the Lord because they never say anything good about me. So, but because Jehoshaphat says, I've got to have a prophet of the Lord, they call in Micaiah, not Micah, Micaiah. And Micaiah says, oh, go ahead, you'll do it. And Ahab says, could tell, must have been sarcastic, because he said, how many times have I told you, don't mess with me, tell me the truth. And so then Micaiah tells this story. And he tells the story that God called the heavenly angels together and asked, how can we get Ahab to go to his death against Ramoth-Gilead? And one spirit said this, and another spirit said that. And finally, one stood up and said, I know, I'll be a lying spirit in the mouth of his prophets. And the Lord said, go and do it. And because of that, people say, oh, God has sent lying spirits. No, God just sent a message of mercy. What the message was, if you understand the context, is the prophet of the Lord is saying, Ahab, your prophets are lying to you. If you go, you will die. And so God sent a message to warn Ahab off so that he wouldn't die. It was a message of mercy, presented in the only way a worshiper of Baal could understand, and that is his prophets received a message from God, because he believed the prophets of Baal were receiving messages from God. And so he was told the messages that he thought he was receiving from God were lies. So God wasn't actually sending a lying spirit. Okay, that's how we understand that. Why does Paul describe believers' faith journey as a race? I understand we need the qualities of focus, fit, determination, endurance to run a race, but who are racing against ourselves, sin, death, the world, lies. In the context of a race metaphor, what are the opponents and what would be the consequences, losing the race and so forth? In life, we also have race. We have the path of righteousness. Lead me in the path. Life is a journey that we're on. And so Paul is using the metaphor of a race because he wants people, if you've ever been in a long race, not a 100-meter race, a 6-mile race, a marathon race, a race that goes on your entire life, the race is not against other people. He has encouraged people, finish the race. Don't get fatigued. Don't get tired. Don't let the cramps, the dehydration, the heat of the day, the sweat, the sun in your eyes, don't let things cause you to quit. Cross the finish line. And later he says, I have finished the race. I have fought the good fight. And the race and the battle, Paul, he had his trials and tribulations externally, but he also, I die daily. The race and the battle is against all of the temptations and discouragements that the devil can throw at us, whether they're external or internal. That's the race we're fighting. We're fighting the race to stay faithful to Jesus and finish the calling that he has called us to live. And that's what he's challenging us to do. Don't give up. Don't get discouraged. Don't give in. Finish the race. Cross the finish line. How do we reconcile our somewhat libertarian liberty of conscience view on not legislating morality with advocating for the prohibition of alcohol and drugs? Also, where would we draw the line? Milk and sugar ferment in the gut and produce alcohol and clouds the mind. So do we vote for a law prohibiting the consumption of milk and sugar? This idea that Ellen White forwards of voting for prohibition really confuses me. And Ellen White did advocate for people to vote to prohibit alcohol. The question is why? Why did she do that? To help promote health, perhaps. I have another theory. What is Ellen White's position? It's all about advancing design laws, prohibition design law or imperial law?
Yeah, imperial.
Well, no, it's kind of design. Yeah. If you drink alcohol, it ruins your health.
Prohibition is imperial. Prohibition is human governments making it illegal for you to use alcohol, and if you get caught, you'll get fined and have your property taken. It has nothing to do with design law. That's prohibition. It prohibits something that, under design law, could be unhealthy. Notice I said could be unhealthy, because Paul actually told Timothy to drink a little wine for his stomach. Why would he do that? Many Adventists would like to believe he was telling him to drink grape juice. He was not. He was telling him to drink a very low fermented 2 to 3 to 5% alcoholic beverage. Why?
How do you know?
Because he was having GI problems. Why do you think he was having GI problems?
The water.
Yes. And what did when the British were conquering the world, what did they, and they're getting water from all of these various streams and places from new lands, and these waters they were getting filtered and purified waters?
Yeah.
No.
So what would they do? They would give their semen grog to drink, which was a very, very low alcohol brew that would take a whole lot to get you intoxicated. But the alcohol killed the pathogens and was actually much healthier for your body in those circumstances without pure and clean water to drink a low-grade alcohol brew that doesn't get you intoxicated, but keeps you from getting sick all the time. And you can actually be more functional for the Lord. So, alcohol can be destructive, particularly when they started learning how to distill it, make the high spirits, the high concentration wines, cause drunkenness. And the Bible prohibits drunkenness. It actually prohibits the ingestion of any amounts of alcohol. If any of you had ever in your lifetime taken some cough syrup, there's a good chance you got a little alcohol with that, because a lot of the cough syrups are suspended in alcohol. Oh my, have I just committed an unpardonable sin? No, because you weren't actually doing something to give enough alcohol to pass the liver enzymes. As the person points out, when you eat certain foods, the bacteria in your gut make alcohol in your gut, and it never makes it to your brain because you have enzymes in your liver that detoxify that before it gets the bloodstream. And small doses of alcohol that you ingest from grog or something like that also never make it past your liver, so it never makes it to your brain. So, you know, a lot of people want rules like no alcohol ever. If you do, you're committing sin, versus understanding the principles, which is what the Bible teaches. Drunkenness is a problem. A little alcohol for your stomach, a little wine for your stomach actually might be healthy as long as you're not getting drunk and getting intoxicated. So anyway, but that requires higher order thinking, a principle-based thinking, and children just need rules. They won't be able to figure that out and dose it properly. So they have rules. So why did Ellen White advocate for prohibition then? One is because she was trying to advance righteousness, trying to advance a moral structure. Well, perhaps, but we see in the Old Testament, God gave laws. He did lots of things. God thundered at Sinai, and it frightened them into obedience for a brief period of time. But after that, were they faithful and loyal? God sent the flood, mighty displays of might and power. And what were they doing right afterwards? Building the Tower of Babel. Were they faithful and loyal? Fire rained down from God at Mount Carmel, and everybody said, the Lord, He is God, the Lord, He is God. And after that, were they faithful and loyal? I think that she advocated for this in a prophetic way as an object lesson and demonstration to show us the fallacy when the beastly system rises, because what happened when prohibition went into place? Did it actually result in not only less alcohol use, but less crime and less evil? Or did it actually magnify the crime and evil? Ah, so there's a wonderful lesson that I think she was led to lead people to learn so that before the end of time comes, we won't fall into the trap of trying to do righteousness through legislation. We have in our own time seen it does not work. So that's what I think was going on there.
I think there's a simpler explanation. I think she was just wrong on that issue. I mean, are we to believe that she never made a mistake? So I don't know that she had the forethought to think, okay, I'm going to advocate for the prohibition of alcohol in order to prove that legislating for morality is ineffective. I think the simpler explanation is she was just wrong on that issue. And we can give her grace for being wrong on that issue.
Peter was wrong on issues. It didn't make him less inspired.
Exactly.
He had to be corrected.
Thanks.
So it's possible she was just wrong on that issue. It's possible also then if she was personally wrong and was going to take this action, that God did not communicate her to her not to because he wanted the lesson
right
demonstrated just like I just said. So both can be true. When Jonah decided to run away, God let him. And in fact, he called Jonah, I think, because he knew Jonah was going to run away. And he wanted to deliver Jonah to the Ninevites who worship Dagon, the fish god, out of the mouth of their god.
Yes.
So I think even if we take the position that she was just wrong on this issue as a human, God could have clearly sent her a message, don't do it, it's wrong, if he didn't want this to happen in his foreknowledge. Yes, he could have.
Oh, yeah.
And if an angel would have come to her with a message, this is not the way to go, I'm confident that she would have stopped doing it. Absolutely. Don't you agree?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the fact that she didn't means it was within God's overall arching will for it to happen. And why? Because it teaches us a really powerful lesson. So I think both can be true. So I appreciate you saying that. Can you please explain the scapegoat? What is the Adventist view and what is your view? Well, I actually agree with the Adventist view. The Adventist view is the scapegoat is symbol, and I can give you some biblical references as to why. Do you understand this? The nature of the great controversy? The nature of the great controversy is over who do you believe? Who do you trust? Satan is the father of lies. Lies infect our mind. As we accept the truth and accept Jesus, both the lies about God that we've accepted are purged from our mind, and all of the fear, selfishness, and exploitation that we did based on those lies goes back to the originator, the one who was the originator of all the lies about God. And then we actually, through symbolically placed on the head of the scapegoat, he goes out in the wilderness away from the camp. I view that as at the beginning of the 1,000 years when all the righteous go to heaven, we actually recognize that God is faithful and true, and Satan is the source of all pain and suffering. And we put Satan responsible for all of this. And you see this in Isaiah chapter 14 in the prophecy about Satan who he was perfect and righteous in all his ways. Isaiah chapter 14 that he was the covering cherub, he was sinless, walked amongst the fiery stones of God's presence, and he wanted to ascend onto high, he wanted to take God's throne, I will rise up, I will be like the Most High, and then he is cast low, he is cast down, and it says, then all the nations said, is this the man? Is this the one? And they see him for who he is. And this is a prophecy of Satan's original rise to try to take high, but how in the end he's cast low and everyone sees him for what he is. And that's what's described there in the symbolism of all the responsibility for all the sin goes back to Satan. And everyone recognizes him for who he is. And then he's in the wilderness of this desolate earth for 1,000 years. And that's why he's taken out to the wilderness. And at the end of the 1,000 years comes the final events of Revelation chapter 20. And then, what are your thoughts on the series The Chosen? I've never watched it. I don't know anything about it. So and it says, is it accurate? So I really don't have any comment to make about it. All right, guys. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.